Can I start?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Hi. My name is Vlad. I'm a student at Western University of Timișoara and a developer at Press Labs. At Press Labs, we do WordPress hosting dedicated to publishers. In the last 4 years, we had some achievements. One of the greatest is we serve 2.2 billion page views in our busiest month and 45 million page views during 24 hours on a single site. But as you can imagine, this business is far from perfect. In our relationship with the client, we discovered a big problem, the conflict between the developers and their, between the publishers and their developers. They both share the same credential, SFTP credential, and they both wanted to change the site in the same time. So usually that means chaos. Now I'm here to introduce you the GitFS file system, which is a fuse file system written in Python, and it's based on Git. Basically what it does, it takes this ugly and messy Git object structure and transform it into a more humanable way and a more readable way. For example, you can see here that we have two layers. We have the current directory and the history directory. In the current directory, we have the current snapshot of the repository. And in the history, we have a collection of snapshots grouped by days and by commits. For example, the first commit was 2051. And it contained only the readme file, and the second one a minute later and contained the PyCon file and the readme.md file. Now for a short demo. Can everybody see that? Okay. Basically, we have here the remote repository, which is usually on GitHub. And here the developers like doing work on a remote machine. And in the developer folder, we had only one file called first. Okay. Now, if we want to mount our remote repository, we only do like calling GitFS with a mount point. Mount it in the publishers and some parameters. And that's it. We have in the current folder the current version of the repository, and in the history of the commit. Now, in order to create some content, we just add another file. And if we go to the developer, do a simple pull, we'll have the second file. It's working the other way, but I'm not going to show you now. Okay, as you can see, it's easy as 1, 2, 3 for everybody to create versioning to create the version content. It's all written in Python and it's open source and free for everybody to use. Because neither of us had any previous experience in writing any file system, we did a little bit of research, and we discovered that we needed two main components. Something to help us with the Git objects, and something with the file system. For the Git, we chose PyKit2 because basically PyKit2 is a wrapper on libgit2, which can easily manipulate the Git objects as low level as possible. In that case, basically we have a small memory footprint and it's very, very efficient. For the file system, we use FuseFile because what FuseFile offer us is they offer an operation class in which you can describe all your syscalls. Just implement those syscalls, put them into memory.py or whatever file you want, and you will have a fully fledged working file system in 10 lines of code. Okay. We implemented the concept of views. So basically, for each directory, for the current history directory, commit, index, so on and so forth, we created the views, and those views are implementing all the syscalls that we needed. And between the actual syscall and those views, we put up a router, which based on the path of the file that is transmitted through the syscall, is going to create the certain view. For example, if we want to read the README file from the past, we just create a syscall read, and that syscall is going to be passed to the router, and the router is going to create a commit view and execute the proper read method. Okay, another nasty fact is that if you are going to do a lot of commits, push, pulling, and so on and so forth, you are going to get a lot of conflicts, and we need a strategy to solve them. So basically, we choose the always accept my strategy to solve those conflicts because it's one is the safest one. And let me show you how we did that. But first, we need to define a conflict. A conflict is defined by something like this. We have, let's say, a branch. Let's say that we have the master branch with the commit 1, 2, and 3. And on the remote, a developer pushes the commits 4, 5, and 6, and the local, our file system loads the commits 7 and 8. As you can see, in order to merge those conflicts and to solve those conflicts with the always accept my strategy, we need to pass the 7 and 8 commits after 4, 5, and 6. First, we found out that the commit number 3 is the parent of the commits 4 and 7. After that, we're able to rename the branches. The remote branch is going to be renamed in merging remote and the local branch in merging local. And in the end, just cherry pick the 7 and 8 commits after 4, 5, and 6. Basically, it's very, very easy and simple. Or this strategy is not implemented in PyG2, so we needed to implement by our own hand. Now, we put it up in production and saw that a lot of performance issues emerge. We mounted the WordPress repository, which has like 70,000 commits, and just a simple listing on all the history of the WordPress project took like 33 minutes, which is huge. So what we did was to implement three layers of cache. The first layer and the most important is the Git object cache. Basically, we are going to read from the disk the commits and the Git objects and their content, put them in the memory, and invalidate this cache at each new commit and basically at each new pull and merge. After that, a lot of views were created. For example, if you are going to read a file very frequently, the new commit view is going to be created each time you're going to read that file. So basically, we just cache all the views, but we saw that it's going to waste a lot of memory if you're going to cache all the WordPress, and we implemented an LRU cache. On top of that, we cache the gitignore and gitsum modules path because each time you're going to write in a file, we need to check that, okay, that path and that file is not in the gitignore file or in the sum module file. So basically, we just cache them as the git objects and invalidate that cache on each new commit. Next, the last problem and the last big problem that we had was the upstream synchronization mechanism. And in order to push all those changes and all those solved conflicts to a remote branch, we implemented a structure like this. So this basically we have four more components, main components. We have the fuse threads, the commit queue, sync worker, and patch worker. Fuse threads are the thread from fuse. We have no control with them. Fuse can spawn 10, 20, 100 threads. After that, we need a new mechanism to communicate with the sync worker. So we use basically a queue, which is just a Python queue. The sync worker is gonna merge all the conflicts and is gonna push to that remote. And the fetch worker is just gonna fetch from the background all the changes from the remote at a certain period. The fetch worker can go in the idle mode if nothing is happening for more than, let's say, 2 days. No activity is going with a few threads. The fetch worker can fetch once per day or once per week in order to save some resources. Okay, now the actual simplified mechanism. Each time you are going to do some writing on the few threads, some write jobs are going to be created, are going to be passed to the commit queue. The commit queue is going to be consumed by the sync worker. The sync worker is going to batch all the commits because, for example, if you unzip a big archive, let's say that with 1,000 files, you don't want 1,000 commit per file. You just want one commit, say, okay, I've just created a new folder, for example. Okay. After that, in order to sync and to merge the actual conflicts, we need a clean staging area. To do that, we just lock all the writes and say to the fuse thread, okay, I understand that you want to do some writes, but for now, I want to merge and I want a clean stage area, so please lock all the writes. In the same time, we notify the fetch workers, okay, please just stop fetching because I cannot push and fetch in the same time. And the sync worker is going to merge all those conflicts and is going to push to the remote. At the end, it's going to notify the fuse thread that, okay, now you can actually write, and to the fetch worker that you can actually fetch, and everything is fine. Okay, now for the final remarks. You can install the GitFS. We have packages built for Ubuntu 12.04 and 40.04. Also, somebody built some packages for Fedora, Arch Linux, and we have Brew script. At the end, you can actually build a production-ready file system. We are using this file system from October with 200-300 clients, and it's working very good. Building a fuse file system is very easy. You can do that in using a tutorial from the internet in less than 100 lines, but do it right is quite challenging. And the soft one, you can give some powerful tools to the non-technical users using the right technologies. If you have some questions.
Perfect slide.
How well does this deal with things like complex trees on the remote side? So you've got several different trees branched off. Does the merge still work well?
Well, yeah, because I'm going to... The GitFS is going to overwrite all your files. So basically, if you have like two changes for a single file, it's going to overwrite all the changes. It's not that smart, but it can...
You won't. Would you lose...
Yeah. But you can implement your own strategy.
You guys are trapped with me now. No escape.
Maybe you're trapped with us.
Okay, so I'm Adam. And I'm going to talk to you about a mobile web of action document. I deliberately picked the most innocuous possible title. That way I can deny any of this happened afterwards. Big question. Have you heard of the web?
Yes.
Okay, anybody want to tell me, what is the web?
Primary school answers.
It's a collection of, actually, it's a interface on top of a collection of protocols and services.
It's a magic box of everything.
I like that answer, actually. So there's a guy here called PSD, and he basically had this wonderful thing. I recommend getting the blown-up version. It's really awesome. It's from 2010, and it's like the web is agreement. It's a whole bunch of things we all agree. We all have our own different perspectives on it, but they all mostly interoperate.
Could you use the microphone, please?
How about, is it better?
No.
I don't think the mic's actually...
Okay, what if I hold it and then shout?
Probably need to turn it on.
Well, okay, we could turn it on as well. Let's see. Anybody now use the microphone?
I think it's the film with downstairs.
No. Anybody at the back know how to use the microphone? Okay, I shall just project.
Or bring you guys forward.
Or you can come forwards.
That's the offline solution. Just bring yourselves forward and then you're grabbing it.
Okay, so the web was an agreement. It's essentially a bunch of different technologies that mostly work together, and whenever the web met anything else, it absorbed it. So if you remember WASTE, Gopher, FTP, the web met these things and then devoured them. So, when I say, what is the web, and we want to break it down into Ian's answer, it's these things. HTTP, user agents, the asterisk is because we say user agents, we mean browsers. In theory, when Tim Berners-Lee started, you could have any user agent you wanted. In fact, his original one did reading and writing. It was awesome. Nobody does that anymore. Actually, anybody here remember the Netscape Communicator Suite? Okay, you guys remember the old days. You'll like this thing. HTML URLs, and of course, the most important element, of course, view source. View source and copy and paste. That's what made the web. Don't believe the tidy histories people will tell you. Nobody knew what the hell they were doing up until about 2005. We were all copying and pasting each other. There's a place called Mac Script Archive for everybody. Because remember, up until about 2005, nobody actually knew JavaScript. Again, people will tell you, oh yeah, I knew JavaScript. No, nobody knew JavaScript. I mean, the guy who invented JavaScript, even he admits, he whipped it up in a couple of weeks, probably cutting and pasting from other people's language implementations. So, we've got this beautiful web. It's an agreement of a bunch of things we've all cut and pasted together that works. Unfortunately, the web is growing up, and it's changing. So, you guys know HTTP? Simple, textual, insecure, inefficient, but really easy to reverse engineer because you could telnet to anything and then type the things you wanted. So you didn't actually need a user agent. You could do it yourself. Unfortunately, we've now moved to HTTP 2. Who's looked at the HTTP 2 spec? Scary, isn't it? So HTTP 2, it's complex. Let's be honest here. It's a lot more complex than HTTP. HTTP, you looked at that, even with HTTP 1, you looked at that and you said, yeah, I could do my own server, it's not that hard. Yeah, I could do my own user agent, it's not that hard. It's just sending bits of text back and forth. I can probably cut and paste that from somebody else's implementation. HTTP 2, well, for a start, it's a binary protocol. No more just reading the traffic as it flows back and forth. Nowadays, everybody's pushing HTTPS by default. Even Wikipedia just announced, as of this week, they're going HTTPS by default. Their gov.uk, HTTPS only. If your browser doesn't support HTTPS, sorry. If your browser supports HTTPS, but you're using a, you only support a bunch of old ciphers and they've rooted those out, sorry. So, you notice when I said the web, I didn't say it was universal. That's because it was never really universal, and it's a lot less universal nowadays. So, HTTP 2 doesn't mandate. The other thing is, HTTP was bloody easy to spell. HTTP 2 has this weird slash. HTTP 2, it's multiplexed. So you can have multiple connections over multiple HTTP 2 connections over one TCP connection. You can do cool things like server push, where the server chooses what to send you over that connection. The headers are compressed using a very specific compression technology. It's very complicated. You can boil it down to that word. So, remember user agents. Remember how I said we claimed we had user agents, but they were really just browsers? Well, now, everybody and their sister has apps which contain HTML pages, which means that they are user agents. That right. The App Store is a user agent store. Many of these user agents contain embedded web views. So they're like Mickey Mouse browsers that don't support the HTTPS properly. They don't have location bars. They don't really do a good job of remembering your history and doing all the cool new things we expect browsers to do today. But they're insanely popular. In fact, what is the most popular browser by time spent on the internet today?
Facebook's
embedded web view. How many of you test your web pages inside embedded web views? Doesn't that bother you? Everybody's using this, but I don't test on that. I test on these things that people aren't using as much. So I work for Google, but this is my day off. So we've got something called Chrome Custom Tabs, which basically lets you replace your embedded web view with a custom Chrome tab that you tart up with your own branding. Safari has FS Safari View Controller as of this week, which does exactly the same thing. Complete coincidence that both companies launched pretty much identical technologies about a week apart. The other big thing that's changed is that before, the web was this thing you used on these things. Now, the web is something you use on these things. So, we're now using, frankly, crappier computers to browse this web in a variety of user agents, most of which aren't very good. And then, of course, the web that I fell in love with way back in 1995, when I first saw Netscape 2.0 load up black text Times New Roman on a gray background, that was a hypertext web. Yeah, we don't have that anymore. We kill documents. It's now web apps. You know, you try and convince people to do pages of HTML. No, they won't do that. They all want you to do JavaScript. So I thought I'd pick some examples of what... If you load up a Chromium instance, switch off JavaScript, and then try to browse the web, this is what you see. That's the Chrome Dev Summit. That's Google's design site. It's completely blank and beautiful blue. And this is SoundCloud, which thinks it's a joke that you can't get hold of their content. Because...
Even the website for this, if you don't have JavaScript enabled, you can't see the descriptions.
Oh, that explains it.
if
you go to Twitter without JavaScript, you don't see any images. Effectively, the message is, don't have JavaScript? Screw you. Which is sad, because it's like they've created a separate web without you. The other thing that's happened is people now treat HTML as object code. Gone are the days of people gloriously copying and pasting HTML and learning how to build stuff, where anybody with one working web page that somebody else had written could teach themselves HTML by just copying and pasting and seeing what it would do. Now, you need to actually know what stuff does, just to begin. Because, of course, nobody's actually writing HTML now. They're all using JavaScript frameworks that are going to fiddle the DOM to create new entities that you're going to see, or they're doing clever server-side rendering and then sending that dynamically using AJAX to the web page. And there's very little HTML in there. They're all using very fancy build tools. Who here is using a build tool for their web pages? I'm just going to look at you with disapproval. The web was a document system. It's a hypertext, and we've thrown all of that away because we want to turn it into a platform. Remember URLs? By the way, who here ever understood the distinction between URLs and URIs? Really? What is the distinction?
I said I used to.
Ian?
Oh, God. a URI is could be anything including... I don't remember.
So, I actually checked this on Wikipedia. Go on.
So, URL is a kind of URI.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, the kind of global identifier.
Yeah, you need you need a third concept, the URN, and there's a relation between these three. And there's you should really look at the Wikipedia page; it's actually quite good. But the point is, we used to have URLs, universal resource locations, uniform. So that's the anyway. So now we have deep links. For those of you who don't know about deep links are essentially a way to link inside an app. And for bonus points, what a lot of people do with deep links is, if you use a site service like URX, you link to some content inside an app. You don't have the app installed. The app uses URX or something to fingerprint your device and the thing you're trying to get to, send you to the App Store or Play Store. When you then install the app you wanted to install, it loads up, it looks up that fingerprint in URX and says, oh, it's this guy, and he was trying to get to this part of my app, and takes you there. We had to do this because the mobile operating systems didn't support the notion of a URL. So everybody had to hack in their own one. And they didn't have the notion of a referrer. So typically with an HTTP thing, this page would send you to the store, which would send you to where you wanted to go, and the referrer would be passed through. That wasn't on the web, so people had to do things like fingerprinting. On iOS, up until last week, when they announced universal linking, you had to use your own custom URL schemes because every link would be grabbed by Safari. There was no way to say, here's a link to pinterest.com/coolpinteresty type stuff, and have the Pinterest app consume that and serve that to you. Pro tip, try going to the Pinterest website on a mobile web browser. Try see if you can get any content. There are multiple layers of pop-ups telling you, you don't want to use this page. Trust me, man, you want to go to the app. You know, they do everything short of threatening to make your phone self-destruct. But they do that because they want to send you to the app. So what's now possible, and it's been possible on Android for a while, is your app can register to say, I am the user agent for this domain, and basically have all of that traffic sent to them. And on iOS, as of iOS 9, which I have on my iPad, it's okay. You can do that now on iOS. So what this means is, if you want to deep link into an app, you can just use a URL. http://something, and it'll take you there. So we've dragged ourselves kicking and screaming way back into the 90s now. You know, but it's taking a long time. So the apps now handle URLs, which means they bypass the browsers. So the apps are now just as important as user agents as browsers. So we've come all this way. We've reinvented all of this technology that was the web. And just like the web absorbed Gopher and WAIS and FTP, there's an argument that the web has absorbed apps. And so the question that this whole presentation is about, the thing I don't know the answer to, the thing that I really want you guys to tell me, is this still the web?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's still a web that, for example, you know, I have a blog, and like bootstrap to it, I guess you could argue that the software I'm using, which is WordPress, is kind of pushing these objects to create the HTML and stuff like that, but I'm still writing for the open web, and I don't really care about what the person uses, because that's not my concern.
You're saying that you're fulfilling your part of this general agreement we talked about earlier, and you're expecting everybody else to fulfill their half of it, but you don't really care about how, which I think is fine. So I think my answer is, does it matter?
Well, if the web has changed, if apps are part of the web, then I suppose it's okay. It's a thing that bothers me, and I thought I'd share my pain.
I mean, all these are using different, I mean, apps and the, you know, HTML, JavaScript, different technologies, but ultimately a lot of them pull from the same APIs. So you'd argue that this kind of API web is the real web, and everything else is just, you know, views for that, those APIs.
I mean, was that the dream? I mean, this is the thing. For me, the web was this thing we dreamt together, and it's like that thing when you look back in your youth and you ask, is, you know, is this what we wanted to be when we grew up?
Feel it, hero. Feel it.
Thank you. Somebody else feels it.
This one's all about the feels.
One of the frustrations I have is the fact that we're going back to the early days of the browser of this site works best in Internet Explorer. I'm seeing a lot of this site works best in Chrome right now. And I find that intensely annoying because I don't use Chrome.
Yeah.
And I don't feel that I should be pushed to a particular web browser just to visit a website. It should be that website works in any browser. And the browser makers shouldn't be, well, in an ideal world, it should be making standards compliant browsers that have common functionality, not creating unique playpens for their own users.
So how do we get new technologies then? Should we get new technologies?
Well, some of us are trying to work on new technologies, but we're not as big as lumbering as Google and Apple and Microsoft and Samsung, so it's very difficult for us.
I don't think it's about the size. I think it's about... You've looked at very much the kind of the protocols and the kind of the building blocks of the web, but I'm also wondering about, you know, I feel like it's quite a lot, is if you can get as many people to write and use social media but on the open web rather than in these kind of silos, then you can start to imagine the kind of things that would happen. You know, people would naturally go out of the apps because all the content is elsewhere. It's all on the open web.
But one of the things I've been arguing is that the apps and the content inside them are also part of the web. I mean, is the content in Twitter's app more available than the content on Facebook's website? Since I can see the content on Twitter's app without needing to sign in, it's got a URL, I can go and fetch it, but the Facebook content, I need an account on Facebook. And
are they not just different rendering engines, different, you know, like UIs for the same content then, if you want to put it that way? So effectively it's still the same data, it's just a different way of representing and displaying it.
Yeah, and I suppose that comes back to your question about browsers. Is the problem that the people who are making that content aren't thinking, here is the data I want to put in the document, and then here are ways to enhance that using these technologies? It seems like they've started with, here is some cool technology, and then after they finished playing with the technology, they found some way to shove in the data.
I see more that there are companies siloing their data in their app, which makes it impossible for you to get in it unless you've got the app on your platform. You don't have the app. If you're Tizen or Microsoft Windows or Firefox OS or any other, and you don't have the app for that site, whether it's Pinterest or WhatsApp, you're screwed. You can't get anything and that's why I mentioned the big companies, because they have the money to pay those developers to port the app to their platform. If you don't, you're screwed.
It's a bit like a question to ask, but how can you actually see the bigger companies actually being motivated to not want to do this siloing information? I mean, I'm like a developer and coder background, so I'm working in for an NGO where it's very much we're using a proprietary software to engage with our members and supporters and hanging. And it's often it's that sort of we're having to learn the basics of technology so that we can actually work out how we're going to get our supporters to take action and, you know, to share stuff. So yeah, that's one sort of thing. What you're saying is like, well, actually, how do you get to that point where you can actually make a strong, motivating business case for, yeah, it's like That makes sense.
I think for me, the pitch is always focus on documents, publishing documents, and then apps are just another user agent, the browser is just another user agent for consuming those documents. Those documents may be exposed by your API, or no, or it could be exposed by going to www.somesite.com. But either way, it amounts, it works. One last question, okay?
Isn't just the inevitable consequence of the growth of the audience? Maybe in, I don't know, in the early 90s or even earlier, the web was the wave of a few geeks. But with the growth of the audience, commercialization is inevitably comes to that. And that's why the apps, that's why when companies become interested in selling something, like our audience grows and companies become interested in selling something, then all it all evolves from there. Like maybe in the early days of automobile industry, it was the domain of geeks, of very few people, and people were more interested in technical characteristics than playing with technology. And now, I don't know, companies sell cars based on the color of rear view mirrors. And that's the selling point. Maybe this is the same happening to the web.
Wow. That's kind of a depressing way to end. Sam, are you up? Come on, let me have a positive way for us to end.
I think it comes to a tipping point at some point. So then we're going to have a catalogue of apps because we want to do so many things, so many companies pushing. I see the niche market of another browser coming into this space because there's technology. So is it the question? I probably think it's going to be a tipping point somewhere, so people are going to be fed up. It's always kind of bad that we can only operate in one way. And we can start to realize, okay, you're going to die. We are diverting customers everywhere, and they're not interested. So like the gentleman said, I don't use it because of these reasons, XYZ, and I'm sure companies start to realize, of course, I want to do business with that gentleman. And I'm losing that customer.
I think we just get. Do we have time?
We can sneak one in. I think Sam's looking and giving.
In 10 years' time, could we not just have a simple protocol that sends stuff out and gets stuff back?
Like a hypertext transfer protocol. I like it. We'll have to come up with a name for it, obviously.
Yeah.
Hat, maybe. Yeah, we'll call it Hat Pie. Hat Pie. Yeah, I like that. Works. Okay, so I'll see you in 10 years' time, and we'll do this.
We'll catch him in the bar later and we'll catch him. So our final speaker and headliner for this room, as it were, is Sam.
I'm not a headliner. a bunch, let me turn that off because I didn't have time. I was busy this week, so I barely have a talk, let alone slides. Sorry. Who's actually here for the meditation talk and who's just in the way between, who's just stuck because they didn't know. They wanted to hear Dave's talk and I'm between them and the bar.
I'm here for a meditation talk.
Okay. So this isn't the normal Open Tech talk because apparently I'm number one of the organisers. And it's also probably not that long because when I thought of doing this on Wednesday evening because I had a hole in the schedule I really needed to fill, this seemed like a good idea and I wrote most of it last night in my hotel room. So, who in the room has some form of meditation practice? Okay, and who is here to want a meditation practice and think that that's what you're going to get from this talk? Okay, well, you're not. If you're looking to learn to meditate, if you have friends who are looking to learn to meditate, there is a book called The Calm Technique. Buy a paper copy from Waterstones across the road. I mean that for a reason, which if you read the book, you will find out, and if you don't read the book, well, never mind. But basically, it's about distraction, and yeah, there isn't Twitter on the next page. So, who's heard about meditation and sort of not interested, but just generally curious? Okay, so that's a good chunk of the... This is now worth doing, especially since it saved me a bunch of work. So, if you were looking for the election talk, that's been moved to the bar. So, If you're looking for advanced meditation stuff, Vinay Gupta, who spoke about selling ideas this morning, has a bunch of stuff. Ask him for a copy of his recordings, because they're brilliant. Somewhat insane, but brilliant. And it isn't about why I meditate, or what I do. It's more about what I do with the results. And yeah, welcome to RevTech. So, as geeks, we know what meditation is. We all deeply know. It's basically debugging, done with intent. So the tech author, Bob Cringely, talked about how for years he was sent the things you plug into TVs, like Chromecast plugins, Amazon Fire Sticks, all of those things, and none of them worked. Never worked, he cited the whole lot. It was always just terrible. And yeah, you know, it's like, these things just don't work with my TV. Tried buying a new TV, still didn't work. And, you know, one night he woke up at 3 a.m. and realised that's because his TV was off. And so there'd been no power to the USB port. At which point none of them would work. Left the TV on standby, worked perfectly. And meditation is basically looking at stuff that you can't figure out, and at some point, when you're in the shower, when you're having a cup of tea, when you're having a cigarette, when you're just in the pub with your friends, you have an idea that goes, this is how we serve. You just have that idea. Meditation is curating that deliberately to do something useful. We've all had a problem that we're banging on for hours, gone for a cup of tea, and gone, of course it won't work because we don't run that code. Change the thing and it works perfectly. Because there was nothing wrong with it, you just hadn't seen the right thing. That's what meditation is, it's doing that deliberately. We know it happens by accident. Can we make it happen deliberately? And it's basically chilling out and stop focusing on something. How do you just sit and think about something and relax? That is what meditation is. And I've completely lost my place in my notes. It's not all positive. Yeah, neither is debugging. But it's a case of, yeah, when you start sitting and looking at stuff, things come up, and generally things that you, yeah, the stuff you've been ignoring all year. What should we refactor this code? Yes, you probably should, but we'll ignore that. The stuff we call technical debt in our, you know, programming world, we call something else at other times. Same thing. Yeah, sometimes the technical debt just doesn't get ignored. How do you look at it? How do you, you know, stay calm in dealing with stuff? That's one of the things that meditation will do for you. And yeah, it's not for everybody, neither is debugging. There are some of my friends who are brilliant programmers, just don't let them debug things for very long, because they tend to get, well, funny is possibly one word. And yeah, it's... So the reason this talk isn't scheduled is, you know, meditation's become one of those hit things. It's like, look, getting talked about, lots of people in Silicon Valley are currently doing it, etc. And the question I have, which will go to Q&A, and I'm aware I'm keeping you away from the bar, is selling ads to people on Facebook, Google, sorry, Eddie, the best use of people's time? Because one thing you was like, yeah, when you start looking at stuff and focusing, it's like, is this actually the right thing to be doing? Which is basically what meditation is. You focus it for debugging on a program, same thing on anything else. And you start to ask really quite annoying questions. The chief exec of Uber is very good about how much he meditates and how it's a good thing. It's like, but is Uber actually, you know, given some of what it is, incredibly good at certain things? All of them? Yeah, they do have an interesting approach to, what's it, yeah, the law. And that's the bit that I actually don't have any answers on. Because, yeah, this is not a rehearsed talk, well, at all. And I have questions, and I don't really know what the questions particularly are, and I was wondering what your questions are, because if I give this talk anywhere else, I could do with answering them. And if you're writing... I seem to have lost my place in my notes. So if you're looking at a meditation practice, if you're looking at basically sitting and thinking about things for 10 minutes, which is basically sitting in the garden having a cup of tea and just relaxing and reflecting on your day, or sitting on the bus going home, or standing on the tube. What is it that you'd want to be thinking about? Open tech is about doing stuff and making the world a better place. That's why, you know, I presume you're all here in the building today, and hopefully you enjoyed all the other talks. So, what is it that everybody else should know? And that's what I thought this talk would sort of be. About 10 minutes, which is about what I thought it would take. And in the 5 minutes before you guys can go to the bar, or you can go to the bar whenever you like, what do you think the other people in this building should have heard about, especially the people with meditation practice, or the people without, or the people who are just completely lost and looking at the bar, what do you think that conversation should be? Because I'm pretty sure meditating and coming up with better ways of targeting ads is probably not the best use of people's time. And that was quite short. Thank you.